pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
And welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Happy Thursday to you. 6 minutes after the hour. Still to come on the program today, we'll hear from State House Majority Leader Nathaniel Ledbetter. He joins us at the bottom of the hour. Also later in the program from the Alabama Policy Institute, Phil Williams will be with us to talk about mask mandates, particularly for school children. And they think that is a step too far by the government. We'll hear from former State Senator Phil Williams. You'll want to stay tuned for that. But joining us now, always a pleasure to have this guest on. He was, when my wife and I lived in Destin, he was our state representative in the Florida legislature. Jeff Miller retires. He steps up, runs for Congress. And now I would argue the country is much better off. Congressman Matt Gaetz joins us on the line. Congressman, how are you this morning? Do we have... Looks like we're going to work
hey,
on...
Jeff, you got me?
Got you now, Congressman. How are you?
All right. Great to be with you. Hey, let me ask you this question. I heard the upcoming information about the news in your show. How do you keep a mask on like a second grader all day?
Well, they don't keep it on first graders, but when you're in the second grade, you graduate up and you have to start wearing the mask. So at some point, you mature enough between first and second grade to wear the mask.
I would like to think that... that we could do that, but I got to tell you, Jeff, we can't even keep masks on the members of Congress all day. A second grade version of me would have likely been like rubbing the mask on like my buddy that's a row in front of me.
Yeah, and then it becomes a unnecessary distraction. And good luck to the teachers that had to enforce a mask mandate on a bunch of second, third, and fourth graders.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, I think there are a lot of things we do need to do in schools. We need to take advantage that as much as one in every five kids in America could be choosing distance learning, homeschooling, a hybrid model. That creates extra spacing in the classroom. You know, we need to use multipurpose rooms, gyms, cafeterias to expand the distance among students. But this notion that we're going to, like, turn this problem from a health problem into a massive discipline problem, picking fights between like students and parents and administrators, getting into whether or not there's disparate enforcement for different types of students, that just sounds like a nightmare. I think we ought to encourage people to wear masks. I try to wear a mask when out there, but like it's just always so the government to sit there and think like, well, if something's good, then the best way for us to achieve it is to use the full police power of government to enforce it, rather than to try to encourage people and work with them and show them that we've got to create an option for students to go back to school for the families that choose that option.
Does it also seem that maybe our second graders are getting a very early dose of big government intrusion in their life, the bureaucracy and the way these rules and mandates are being enforced?
Yeah, I mean, if they'll muzzle you in the second grade, you know, I mean, wait till you see what the government will do after that. And I mean, Jeff, speaking of muzzling, I think the biggest story right now in America is the fact that our social media companies are literally banning the President of the United States for sharing information that even some public health officials agree with regarding transmission rates for young people and the likelihood that they'll pass along this virus. I mean, what kind of world do we live in where the tech overlords in Silicon Valley can silence and stifle the communication of the leader of the free world?
I mean, that's something that they have become more knowing than our government, or at least in their minds, they are more knowing than the President of the United States, a duly elected President of the United States, won the election fair and square, despite what other people say, that you have just a few well-placed companies in Silicon Valley that can say, no, we disagree with that, therefore we're not allowing this information to get out.
And we're allowing that to happen. Like, why is the Department of Justice not in a federal court today seeking an injunction against these companies to stop them from this election interference? I mean, we have an election coming up, and I think that you're just going to see them ratchet down harder and harder and harder on not just the president, but his allies as well. I mean, if they can disappear the President of the United States' speech, think what they could do to the rest of us who are just you know, offering a thought or a perspective or a piece of information that we want to share with our fellow Americans. What Twitter and Facebook are doing today is truly a greater threat to our democracy than any Russian troll farm, you know, under a ghost indictment oceans away.
Congressman, is it reasonable to even think that something could be done with Section 230 to strip these companies of their liability protection? You know, they get special carve-outs. That did me sitting behind this microphone, I wouldn't get that, or writing stories for you know, any website. I don't get that protection necessarily, but they get a protection that has allowed them to thrive kind of in this media culture.
Yeah, I mean, I push back on my fellow libertarian thinkers when they say, oh, well, you know, you want to hurt the tech companies, that's just too much government. No, it is a special government carve-out and protection that they got that, as you said, Jeff, you don't get, that has allowed them to grow so big and control the flow of information to such a massive extent. But here's the honest truth, if I'm just going to be straight with your listeners. Congress will never really revise Section 230, because Congress is bought off by big tech. If they're not bought off from PAC donations and campaign donations, there a lot of them have family members, relatives, who work for big tech. I mean, Senator Schumer's own daughter works for Facebook, and then Facebook sends, you know, millions upon millions of dollars, you know, to and through Senator Schumer to liberal causes. And so I think that it's, and liberal candidates, I should say, and so I think that it's unrealistic for Congress to respond to this threat. I do think there is no excuse for the inaction from the Department of Justice. I mean, they're over there, I think, sitting on their hands when we need active litigation against the companies that are eroding our democracy. I mean, our Department of Justice would have got a special counsel, when a drug, like cryogenically unfroze Robert Mueller and, like, you know, trotted his specter around the Capitol over this fiction of this, like, massive Russian interference intertwined with the Trump campaign. We now all know that was bogus. Can we get, like, one-tenth of that effort to go after Facebook and Google and Twitter when they silence our president and when they disadvantage the truth itself by trying to, you know, impose their woke-topian values on the rest of us?
But do your colleagues on the left there, they seem skeptical of Facebook. They, and I, you know, how much of this is really honest assessment from them, but they want to blame Facebook for the 2016 loss of Hillary Clinton. And it, like you said, are they really that concerned over big tech, or do they kind of know, but they had to kind of feign this outrage?
So the interesting thing about tech debate in D.C. is that it doesn't align along traditional party, you know, Republican, Democrat, you know, divisions. And so you have, I think, some populist leftists who have aligned with populist right-wingers like myself to try to tell the truth about big tech. But you know, covering Washington as you do, that place is run by the Uniparty. That place is run by establishment Republicans and Democrats who I think work together to, you know, enhance multinational corporations, sell out to big tech, you know, get our nation in unnecessary wars in every corner of the globe, and kind of that operational uniparty of the establishment protects big tech. They've been doing it for a long time, and they have the ability, despite people like Elizabeth Warren and David Cicilline, who are Democrats, attacking the largesse of big tech, you have the establishment protecting them.
In some ways, it's just professional wrestling. Like, they get up there and you know, they show off for their ideological sides, but really the fix is in, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, it's look, there is no excuse for what we see going on right now. We held a hearing in the antitrust subcommittee where we proved that technology companies steal from Americans, spy on Americans, are dishonest about the extent to which they can manipulate search results. And yet, there doesn't seem to be a legislative response that is all that likely, because, you know, like, we live in a system where, you know, one, two, a few senators can really block any major reform. And so, like, I think big tech has probably got multiple lobbyists for every member of the United States Congress and the United States Senate, and they just hound you and hound you to, you know, see things their way. Now, I'm the only Republican returning to the Congress that doesn't take federal PAC money, and so I am not beholden to them at all, and I feel liberated to speak the truth. But a lot of my colleagues are very dependent on their donations, and again, even some of my colleagues have seen their family members employed by big tech. They're not going to go and spit in the face of the person putting bread on the table of one of their family members. It's sickening.
Joined by Congressman Matt Gaetz, represents Florida's 1st Congressional District. Congressman, the let's kind of switch gears to COVID relief here. You said something, the last time we talked, you said something that there was a possibility here where Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi, they seem so far apart, but the unholy bargain that might be brokered, that there may be a liability protection component to whatever relief package is passed, but Democrats will get a whole, all their wish list or some of their wish list, some of the things that include a bailout for the blue states, stuff that just seems like a step too far. How do you feel about that today?
Well, what sickens me about Washington is if, like, the Republicans have a $1.5 trillion relief package, and the Democrats have a $3 trillion relief package, you know, most normal people would say, okay, well, you're going to end up somewhere between the two. But the reality is the greatest likelihood of Washington is that would become a $4.5 trillion relief package. They just add them together. You know, the easiest bipartisanship to achieve in Washington is deficit spending and just turning on the cash printing machine over at the Federal Reserve. But there are these policies, changes that Republicans are fighting for that Democrats are going to make us pay for with dollars. One of those, as you said, liability protections to get businesses open and running, not liability protections for people who are, you know, grossly negligent or people who just flaunt the rules and, you know, make you a coronavirus Shirley Temple at your local watering hole. But I do think that for kind of the basic operations that people are adhering to cleanliness and sanitation standards, there should be some protections. And then the other major thing we got to talk about is this unemployment system, where in some states, employers are not able to re-onboard their workforce because the employees are making more by not working. This is creating really bad tension between employers and employees. It's stifling the V-shaped recovery that I think we were poised to be in. And so we cannot just allow ourselves to regress into some sort of like universal basic income in drag by extending forever these payments to able-bodied people who have the opportunity to go back to work, but who are not economically incentivized because of a bad government policy.
Joined by Congressman Matt Gaetz. Congressman, we've got just a few moments here left remaining. Sally Yates' testimony yesterday seemed to have thrown Jim Comey under the bus with the whole Russia investigation and the origins of it. What's your takeaway from that Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday?
We know what happened. We know that the Susan Rice, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Jim Comey crowd was all assembled, and that they were going to use Comey as the inside man in the Trump government to try to bring down the duly elected president. And I think that they were so embarrassed at their own foreign policy failures with Russia, at their own political failures with Hillary, that they were using this to justify their own, you know, bad outcomes. And so I'm a little just, you know, I'm sort of sick of the hearings for the sake of hearings, Jeff. I mean, when I go around my district and beautiful Destin, Florida, people ask me, when are these people going to jail? I mean, when is there going to be some accountability? Attorney General Barr has been telling us about this Durham investigation for more than a year. I mean, in 5 months, you know, Robert Mueller was flinging out subpoenas and indictments and rocking and rolling, and here the Durham investigation appears to be in, like, you know, in fourth gear. I mean, so let's get this thing up and rolling, and my hope is that we will see the indictments that will vindicate justice.
And finally, we want to get this in. You got a book coming, Firebrand, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the MAGA Revolution. Folks want to find out about that. Tell them a little bit about what to expect from that.
Yeah, this book's out in September, available for pre-order now. I wrote about my interactions with the president, the first family, others in Congress. Someone told me that reviewed it that this is the first tell-all book about Congress written by someone still in Congress. So make sure to order it, and you'll get the behind-the-scenes look at the president and the good and the bad that happens in Washington, D.C.
Congressman Gates, also one more plug. He's got a podcast. You can go check out Hot Takes from Matt Gates. You can get it just about every podcast application. But, Congressman, as always, I want to thank you for making time for us.
Thank you, Jeff. Enjoy.
All right. That was Congressman Matt Gates of Florida's 1st Congressional District. We got to get a break in here. We will be right back. This is FM Talk 106.5. Proud, yeah, and I'll be proud. I play guitar and I sing my songs in the sunshine. Captain and cloaks and barroom jokes keep me feeling fine. And there's always a stage and a beautiful babe to squeeze my life. And welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Good Thursday morning to you. Coming up in the next segment, we'll hear from State House Majority Leader Nathaniel Ledbetter. Also on the program today from the Alabama Policy Institute, Phil Williams, former state senator from Etowah County, will join us. Got anything on your mind? Give us a call, 251-343-0106. That also works. You can text us as well. Any reaction to anything you've heard today, happy to hear from you, so let us know what you're thinking. Rand Paul yesterday goes on Fox News and starts talking about debt and just how we talked about this in the last segment with Congressman Gates a little bit. Just how willing Democrats and Republicans are these days to run up the debt. $5 trillion in 5 months. It's becoming, these numbers are very arbitrary in our minds. They're just numbers. They're like mileposts on a highway somewhere that you're not really paying attention to. But remember, when Barack Obama was president, and all of the frustration and outrage and the just what is government's role in our lives, and that led to that Tea Party rebellion, and it gave Republicans the House in 2010. But there was a lot of energy there. It didn't give them the Senate. Some miscues there politically on the Senate. But ultimately, in 2014, that next midterm, Republicans were able to get the Senate. But we don't talk about that anymore. Do people, my question is, do people really care about the debt as much as they used to? Do they? I think there is a component here, psychological perhaps. It doesn't really impact me. Why am I worried about it? That people don't really fully understand debt. They see what's going on in Greece or Venezuela, and they think that could never happen here in the United States of America. They see what happens to these third world basket case governments, where you have runaway inflation, to Brazil even, you know. But it doesn't really register. It could happen here. We're the world's reserve currency. We can run up to this. So Rand Paul yesterday, he does say something very interesting. He says, Republicans, he said, should apologize to President Obama for complaining he was spending and borrowing too much. He was a piker compared to their borrowing and what they are doing now. And that's true. You remember how upset and outraged we were about Obama? Obamacare, a new entitlement, the cost, a housing bailout, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's no longer on the radar, debt deficits, deficit spending. We've seen this before, but Donald Trump, not exactly a physical hawk, I would say, when it comes to spending issues. But we're in a peculiar time, obviously, a pandemic, and that calls for extraordinary measures. But does it just seem, now that we've already put $3 trillion out there, a lot of money. That's a huge amount of money, even though it just sounds very like a crazy number out of air. What could happen next? And do we just keep doing this for everything along the way? Once you do it one time, it's easier to do it the second time, that third time, that fourth time, etc. At some point, we got to get it under control, I would argue. But there doesn't seem to be the political will there. Where are our deficit hawks? Where are our guys like Mo Brooks? Are they being heard from? Do we get them enough airtime? But you got to understand, I think the problem is with the public right now, they don't understand the implications of what it could mean for interest rates, what it could mean for inflation, what it could mean for future expenditures. Our kids and our grandkids, they will be saddled with this debt. How long have we been hearing that? I've been hearing that all my life. So until people feel some kind of consequences from this spending and borrowing, then it may just be kind of something people shrug off and they go on about their daily lives, because that's generally how this works. Everything the federal government does impact us at some point along the line. Maybe it's gradual, but it doesn't seem to be coming up very much in this political cycle, at least, perhaps in future political cycles. We got to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
In Dixieland alike, we tell stories about what goes on in Montgomery at midnight. 'Cause Music Row ain't only in Tennessee. So won't you bury me in Dixie?
And welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Still to come on the program today, we'll hear from former State Senator Phil Williams of the Alabama Policy Institute. Talk about coronavirus, COVID-19 response, things of that sort, particularly dealing with our school system. So make sure you stay tuned for that. But joining us now, he is the majority leader in the State House of Representatives. Hails from Rainesville. Nathaniel Ledbetter joins us. Representative, how are you today?
I'm good, Jeff. How are you doing today? I like that song coming in. He's playing some of my buddies and my neighbors here in DeKalb County on there. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, we try to give it that local flavor the best way we can, even though we are a good spread away here down here in Mobile from Fort Payne. Representative, first of all, let me ask you this: how are things going in DeKalb County in your district with COVID-19? How are people reacting? How's the economy?
You know, things are probably in DeKalb County like they are across the state. We're next week start back to school in the county and the city system, and everybody I think is a little nervous about that. But I think numbers are down a little bit over the last couple of days, and trying to work through what's going on and trying to use every precaution that we can with the CDC guidelines and distancing and making sure you keep your hands clean and wearing a mask. So much like everybody else, I think the way the thing is going with the virus has kind of got everybody on edge, and rightfully so.
Well, that is a perfect segue to our discussion about your op-ed you had on Yellowhammer News earlier this week. Let's talk about schools reopening, teachers. You really herald the courage of teachers that are willing to go to the classroom right now. Talk about their role, at least trying to achieve some kind of normalcy throughout this pandemic.
Yeah, Jeff, as you know, of course, you and I have been friends for a while, and certainly congratulations on your new job here, and I know you're going to do great, but it's personal for me because I have two sons that teach, and I have both of my daughter-in-laws teach, and then we got four grandchildren that's in public school. So I commend the teachers for what they're stepping up to do. The ones that's going back are the ones that's doing virtual school, either one, because it's going to be difficult either way. It's a challenge. Education and teaching is a calling, I think, and a profession that you're called to, probably, and it's going to be tough, and we've never had an environment like this in my lifetime, and I think one of the issues is just the unknown, but teachers have always been the ones that, they educate our children, they put doctors and lawyers out in the real world, and so at this time, they certainly, I think, deserve our support, and anything we can help them do, we certainly want to do that.
What do you say to these teachers or anybody that's employed by a school system that's worried about getting back and perhaps contracting the virus? What would be your reaction to them?
Well, they're rightfully so. A concern I think they all should have, and I think the precautions that they take is so important. along with the systems, to making sure that they are sanitizing and cleaning the rooms, you know, before and after kids come in and out, having a good plan of how to, I know most of the schools are bringing lunch to the classroom. And, you know, the thing about, I guess, in school in rural Alabama, there's a lot of the parents that have to work, both parents, and you know, it's tough to try to find someone to keep the children during the day. I mean, you send them in an environment, whether it's a kindergarten kid or a younger kid that has to have a babysitter or daycare. I mean, you still send them into the same situation, or there's a number of kids there. So, I understand what they're going through, and you know, we had a very tough session early on, trying to finish up the session and getting the budgets out. And looking back on it now, I know it's concerned about it maybe coming back at this time of year, but there was less of the virus then than there are now. I'm glad we got those budgets out for education and for our general fund. But understandably so. I mean, I get it. You know, we got grocery store workers, we got utility workers, we've got people out there every day trying to keep the economy going and making their payments that's been out there in it for a while. So it certainly is a challenge.
Do you foresee you know, the all this cleaning and all these precautions that are having to be taken to get these schools open, and that seems to me like there would be an added expense there. Is there an application or some kind of way to make sure those costs are covered when the bills come due?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're fortunate enough that the federal government sent $1.9 billion to Alabama in the CARES Act, and I was one of the members that is on that oversight committee with the governor, and we got the funding to do that. And I every school system is aware of, Dr. Mackey knows that we've already allocated a certain amount of money for that, and we can use that funding with anything related to COVID-19. It adds additional expenses, so all that can be covered with the CARES fund. And certainly I think Dr. Mackey is well aware of that and has tapped into it with the governor, and with the numbers that we've given them, I think there's more than enough money to take care of those problems. And the only problem is it goes to December the 31st, so after that, then we're going to be looking at, you know, different means.
You're going to have to find the funding somewhere, but I guess the hope is that with whatever Congress is trying to figure out the next phase of this, that maybe there's some hope there for some more help on that in that area.
Well, I think so. And then, you know, the flexibility, maybe giving a little more flexibility to use it the way that the states determine is necessary. And, you know, even looking at the numbers and seeing how much of the funding's being used and extending that deadline past December the 31st would certainly be helpful for the state.
We're joined by State House Majority Leader Nathaniel Ledbetter here on FM Talk 106.5. Just more broadly talking about COVID-19 and the direction we're headed. Obviously, the social distancing guidelines and reduced occupancy have been in place for a while, and now we have a mask mandate. Are you satisfied with some of the results we're seeing? Do you feel like that while maybe we're not curing it or eradicating COVID-19, that things are somewhat under control?
Well, I don't know if I'd go as far as saying they're under control. I think we still got a lot of challenges in front of us, and you know, I understand that some people's not comfortable with the mask mandate, and I get that. And I think, you know, most part, people are going to be responsible, and they're going to do what they want to make sure that they take care of themselves and their neighbors and their families. And I wish that we could eradicate it, and you know, I don't know what the outlook is for that. I mean, there's a lot of different scenarios out there. To be honest with you, this thing really started, if you look at it, it started here in March, but in January and the country, and we still, in my opinion, we still have more questions than we do answers. And I hope, you know, that the vaccine comes out that's viable and is able to treat it. And I think in reality, looking at it, that may be the only way that we're able to control it.
We just need to do the best that we can until that vaccine becomes a reality, it seems.
Well, there's no question about that. I think the thing about it is, I think everybody wants to go on with their lives, and that's rightfully so. I mean, everybody, this is the thing, Jeff, and I know people get critical sometimes if you make a decision that they don't agree with, and I certainly understand that, but there's not a correct decision. I mean, you know, with everything that's going on, Governor Ivey and Dr. Harris are doing the best that they can, and do they have the answer? Absolutely not. But, you know, everybody is so intense right now because of the virus and what's going around, and worried about their families and worried about their jobs and worried about the livelihood. It's easy to be on edge, and you always think, you know, well, we should have done this or we should have done that, but it's tough. I mean, it's tough on Governor Ivey. She doesn't take this lightly. I've been in conversations with her at length about this on that committee, and they're doing the best that they can. I mean, I wish we wasn't in this situation. You know, you and I talked before session began. You know, we had a great opportunity. Our state was growing better than or faster, or the economy was doing great. We had a 2.7% unemployment, had thousands of jobs, brought millions or billions of dollars to our economy. And then this thing hits, and it's just turned it upside down. But I think the thing about it is we got to be patient and be cautious of what we're doing. But I certainly think that better days are ahead. And, you know, Alabamians are strong. I mean, we've seen that with tornadoes in North Alabama in my area and hurricanes in South Alabama. And we're resilient people in the state. And I feel strongly that on the back side of this thing, we're going to come out of it swinging and stronger than we've ever been.
Last question on this subject. Do you think there's the possibility that we roll back some of the openings and go back toward a situation where we have to lock down some things if things were to go in that other direction?
Yeah, you know, I hope not. I would certainly hope not. The thing about it is, I think some people may not understand, when this thing first hit, Governor Ivey, actually, a lot of the businesses and industrial companies kept going. You know, the ones that shut down, a lot of them shut down at their own will, or because they couldn't get supplies, or because the parent company had shut it down. But that's one thing I think has helped us a little more. If we look at our numbers, we hadn't been hit hardly as hard probably as some of us had thought. But I think that's part of it. And I think for us to go back and try to shut it down again, I hope not. I really hope not. I think, you know, a lot of things has got to happen. And I know a lot of people criticize some people going back to school and having kids in classroom. You know, it's not, the thing about it is, if you look at and listen to the professionals, and my work on the mental health issue, and you hear a lot of people talk about kids staying at home without interaction with other kids and what it does with them mentally and how it affects them. You also hear about the lack of nutrition for some of those kids. You hear about the lack of, you know, parents having the ability to teach some of those kids too. So, I mean, you know, there is issues on both sides of this thing, and it's a balancing act. So, I mean, it's easy to criticize the ones that's decided to go to school. And I don't think we need to be criticizing right now. I think we need to be working together and trying to get through this thing together. It's easy to criticize. It's hard to be a leadership where you can work together and agree to disagree and move forward. And I think that's where we need to be today. We need to agree to disagree on some of these issues. But at the end of the day, we've elected Governor Ivey to make those decisions. And I don't agree with all the decisions she makes, and I don't think nobody else agrees 100%, but she's in a tough situation, and I think she's trying to do what's best for the people of the state.
Leader, I want to segue to another topic here, change gears, that is, before I let you go. The DOJ last week had a report, a memo, or whatever you want to call it, criticizing the way the Alabama Department of Corrections was handling prisons. Some of this goes back to 2018, some of the incidents they cite. This seems like this issue, it just continues to persist with the prisons. What do you make of that from the Department of Justice, and where do you think you guys in the legislature or at the state level are headed on it?
Well, as you know, the governor is looking at some bids now, and I think we'll see some of those come out as far as facilities are concerned. You know, some people have a tendency to forget that we funded to hire 500 new employees last year, and we're in the process of hiring more. Now, because of the pandemic, I don't think that Commissioner Dunn has got all those in place. He's certainly working on that. I asked him directly about that question and how it's going. They hadn't been able to hire everybody that they need. I mean, sometimes it's easy to tear down a fence that you hadn't built. So we've got to look at where we've come from. I mean, if you remember, the overcrowdedness in our prison just 4 years ago, we had over 200% overcrowding. Today, we're about 150%. So we've made changes. And, you know, we have tried to put more people in those jobs to help with that and increase salaries to try to keep them. The turnover ratio was unbelievable in the correction system. So that was two of the things that we really worked to do. And, you know, we hope that they'll continue to fund those, and then the extra pay will help those people stay on the jobs. And, you know, we got a lot of work to do. There's no question about that. You know, when we first started talking about this, first year I was in, this is 6 years ago now, we didn't have the fund. I mean, the bottom line was we did not have money. And so in the process of things changing, the economy getting better, changing some of the way that we do budgeting, those things have improved. You know, the pandemic's hit, and it's kind of changed it again some. But I think, you know, this is something that's not going to happen overnight. It didn't get this way overnight, but they are working on it to try to improve it. And, you know, to see some of what the DOJ has put out now is a little bit disturbing, because they know that we have been working on it, and they know where we're at. You know, some of the things you're talking about happening inside the prison should not be happening, and somebody's got to be held accountable for that. So we've got to continue to work on it. I mean, it certainly is something that I think that's going to take a lot of attention and continue to work on.
Leader, we got to leave it there. As always, I want to thank you for making time for us, and also I failed to mention you do serve as my home away from home when I'm there at the State House. Always appreciative of you letting us do our shows from your office. But we'll have to do this again real soon.
Hey, I'd enjoy that, Jeff. Always good to talk to you, and congratulations on your new job there. You moved from a pretty part of the state to another pretty part of our state, so. I know the people down there are fortunate to have you in that area.
Hey, thank you for those kind words. That was State House Majority Leader Nathaniel Ledbetter joining us. We got to take a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Good morning, I'm Jessica Taloney with WKRG News 5 this morning. Students in Saraland return to the classroom today for the first time since March. The Saraland School District is the first on the Gulf Coast to go back to school. 88% of students in Saraland will return to the classroom. 12% have chosen to begin the school year learning from home. A high school baseball coach and former assistant principal has been indicted by a Neskambia County, Alabama grand jury for theft. Coy Campbell coached at East Bruton's W.S. Neal High School. We're told he left the school earlier this year for a job in Flomaton. The coronavirus pandemic is expected to have an effect on the 2020 census count. The Census Bureau says it is stopping field operations to count the population a month early at the end of September. The Bureau says it's moving up the date to finish compiling the information by the December 31st deadline. Only 60% of Alabama households have responded to the census. I'm Jessica Taloney, WKRG News 5, local coverage you can count on.
What do you want a da-da-da?
What do y'all want a da-da-da?
I have not a da with a da-da-da.
We could switch to Progressive, da.
Oh, yeah?
We could switch to Progressive and sa.
Mm-kay.
We could sa and have to buy some za.
Oh, yeah. Let's switch to Progressive, to da, and get some za with the money we saw.
Yeah.
Now we know we're gonna da-da-da.
These days, nothing is normal and everything is weird. But you could still save big when you switch to Progressive. It might just be the most normal thing you da-da-da.
Quote to da at Progressive.com.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Hiring is challenging. Just ask Dylan Miskowitz, the COO of Cafe Altura.
We needed a director of coffee in order to move our products forward. It felt like we were looking for a needle in a haystack.
Dylan started using ZipRecruiter and found his perfect candidate in a few days.
We were very impressed with how quickly we had quality candidates apply through ZipRecruiter.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter ZipRecruiter, get a quality candidate within the first day. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/search. That's ZipRecruiter.com/search.
This Danny Lipford homeowner tip is brought to you by Robertsdale Power Equipment, your full-line sales and service dealer for all lawn and garden brands. Robertsdale Power Equipment, Highway 59 South, right at the split by the Catholic Church.
If you've tried to create a stepping stone pathway, you know leveling them can be a challenge. I'm Danny Lipford with Tips for Today's Homeowner. Stay tuned and we'll talk about a way to simplify the process right after this. Mold on your siding, moss on your roof, mildew on your deck. The easiest way to get rid of it all is with Wet and Forget Outdoor. There's no scrubbing, no rinsing, and no pressure washing. Just spray and leave. Wet and Forget Outdoor is non-caustic and safe for any outdoor surface. Just spray and you're done with Wet and Forget Outdoor. Get Wet and Forget Outdoor at participating Ace, Walmart, and Lowe's home improvement stores, or visit wetandforget.com for a store near you. A stepping stone pathway is a great solution to a beaten down track across your yard. But the key to a good installation is keeping the stones evenly spaced and level so they're safe and easy to navigate. Sometimes after you dig out and level the soil for a stone, it will rock when you step on it. Rather than trying to find the high spot, figure out where the low spots are by rocking the stone side to side or front to back. Then toss a handful of sand into these spots and replace the stone. Now wiggle the stone back and forth with a little pressure on top. You'll compact the necessary sand and force out the excess so that the stone sits firmly in place. I'm Danny Lipford with Tips for Today's Homeowner.
Feel like the yard work just never ends? Husqvarna's robotic 450X auto mower gives you a better looking lawn with less effort. The Husqvarna auto mower maneuvers around your lawn without supervision, even over tricky terrain and around obstacles, and it knows when it needs power and directs itself back to the charging station. With convenient control options, the Husqvarna auto mower allows you to set it and forget it, even from your smartphone. The smartphone safety and anti-theft features alert you if the Husqvarna auto mower is ever compromised or taken outside the designated perimeter. It also sends a GPS tracking signal in cases of theft. Thanks to Husqvarna, you can have a worry-free, great-looking lawn and more time for activities you really enjoy. Visit Robertsdale Power Equipment today to see how they can help you with all your lawn and garden needs. Highway 59 in Robertsdale, right at the split by the Catholic Church. And visit online at robertsdalepower.com. Husqvarna, ready when you are.
All right, let's take it on down from Muscle Shoals through Decatur. Over Spanish Fort into Mobile, my hometown. Mr. T.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Still to come on the program today from the Alabama Policy Institute. Phil Williams joins us in the next hour, so make sure you stay tuned. Going to open up the phone lines here. Got wide open segments coming up, 251-343-0106. That also works on the text line, so feel free to weigh in or call it or whatever floats your boat. We got a lot of show to go here still. This just kind of breaking from the Washington Post. Actually, it was teased like we were finally going to get to see something from Donald Trump and the taxes and the New York AG. Well, anyway, New York Attorney General instead has thrown out a flashbang grenade, seeks to dissolve the NRA in a suit accusing gun rights group of wide-ranging fraud and self-dealing. This is, I predict, not going to go anywhere. It is purely political. I think it's retaliation for a pledge from the NRA to spend $50 million or some amount on the election. So we'll get more into that in the next hour, so stay tuned. This is FM Talk 106.5.
In the redneck Riviera, it's getting crazy. I'm getting hammered, sitting right here at the floor of family.